First order of business is approval of the minutes from March 29th. Representative Lehman moves approval of the minutes from March 29th. Are there any corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Ex officio member, Representative Knobloch. The chair, I don't think you can move the bill as an ex officio member, can you?
Or? I cannot, Mr. Chair, I am told.
I'm sure no one on this committee would move it for you, so I'll do it as a courtesy to you, Representative Knobloch. As the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, you might have a couple people who want to move it for you. So the chair will move House File 4342. I'll be recommended for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Knobloch, do you have any amendments to your bill?
No, I do not have an amendment to this bill.
Representative Knobloch, to your bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 4342 would allocate $650,000 of dislocated worker funding to provide training to people affected by the closure of Electrolux in St. Cloud. Electrolux has a large freezer manufacturing plant that currently employs 900 people in St. Cloud. This plant has been producing freezers for approximately 75 years. As an interesting aside, it occupies the original buildings that once housed the Pan Auto Company, which made automobiles in St. Cloud 100 years ago. A few months ago, Electrolux announced that they would be closing this plant at the end of 2019 and relocating their operations to facilities in South Carolina. We are fortunate we have roughly 2 years of notice before the plant closes and that the economy is doing fairly well. Nevertheless, this is a major blow to our community. The jobs at Electrolux are good jobs with benefits. There are many other employees in the community that are also dependent on this, such as cardboard box manufacturers and others. In addition, about 25% of the workforce in this plant are refugees who have come to the St. Cloud area in the last 15 years. Deed has already been working on this issue, and I have had meetings with them, and I appreciate their work. However, current law requires that an RFP be extended in cases such as this, and our experience in greater Minnesota, particularly in St. Cloud, is that we normally have only one local provider, Career Solutions, our local workforce center, that bids on such RFPs. However, going through this RFP process delays getting help to people that need it. And in addition, since this plant closure is so far in the future, waiting for the required 90-day notice of plant closing, which will not be issued for over a year, seems to be unproductive. And so it seems to make sense to get going with this training and this programming right now. House File 4342 recognizes that with the plant closure is coming, it jumpstarts the process of training people now so that they will be more ready to take other jobs when they lose their job at Electrolux. And it appoints Career Solutions to coordinate the training work, which will give us further time to train all these employees. I'd appreciate your support, and I have Tammy Beery with Career Solutions here to provide other testimony.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Tammy Beery. I'm the Executive Director of Career Solutions. We are the Workforce Service Area number 17 that covers Stearns and Benton County. We also have a regional partnership with Central Minnesota Jobs and Training based out of Monticello that covers also Sherburne and Wright. That's a part of the St. Cloud community.
If I could ask you a favor, just take your microphone and turn it up a little bit towards you. There you go.
How's that? All right.
Thanks.
Just to give you a snapshot of the employees that work at Electrolux, 78% of them are over 40 years of age. 54% are over 50 years of age, with at least 20 years, many of them with 20 years experience. There's 15% that are over the age of 60. I know there's actually a gentleman there that's in his 80s. There's 7 different languages spoken in the plant, and in the St. Cloud area, the only other employers that can handle such different languages are outside the Metro Transit system by about 20 miles. So for them to go to another employer, if they speak another language, can be a challenge. 20% are Somali, and with looking at the number of years of service, over 70% have 10 years of tenure at the organization, which means they're receiving a decent amount of pay. They're very high-paying jobs with or without a GED or diploma. Based on a survey that was conducted by St. Cloud State and the U of M Extension, there are approximately 135 people that work in that industry that do not have a GED or diploma. When Deed's rapid response team went in to survey the employees, it was a simple two-page survey that some of them took it home to review and complete, and many of them needed one-on-one assistance completing that survey. These are indicating that there are strong needs for education, basic education, within the workforce. If we were to receive this funding, I view it as a precursor to the Dislocated Worker Program, where we actually try to achieve credentials. We have a lot of pre-work that needs to be done with these individuals. English as second language courses are needed. GED and diploma courses are needed. The human resource staff have indicated that many of their staff need basic computer skills. And nowadays, you need basic computer skills to fill out a job application for another job. We would also look at assessing what career fields they're interested in so we can start to develop cohorts and clusters for either positions that are in apprenticeship-type positions or cohorts through either the technical college and other industries to start looking at welding and machining, plastic molding, some of the other manufacturing positions that pay well in the St. Cloud area. We would start to work with the operations team. There's about 70 people in the office that 35% of them have four-year diplomas, so degrees, so that's also a group that we would target to work with. So really, it's what this money would allow us to assess the situation and start with the beginning levels of education so that as we get towards the dislocated worker funding, we can hopefully have people that are stronger and able to enroll into credentialed programs. The impact study that was done by SCSU and the U of M Extension Office says that there's approximately 1,800 jobs in the community that will be affected by this plant closure. I have a number of community agencies that are rallying around and asking, what can we do to help? What can we do to get started? It's rare that we have this much advance notice on a layoff. I think if we were to wait until dislocated worker starts, which is 6 months prior, this is time that's wasted. We have an opportunity to get in there and start working with these individuals to get them on the right career path. As Representative Knobloch mentioned, competitive process in Greater Minnesota does vary. The experience does vary based on what happens in the metro area. According to Deed's policy, the service providers that can compete for this project are either other W workforce service areas that have one of the plants affected in their area, which there's only one plant, and that is in Career Solutions area. The other service providers need to have an established office within 50 miles of the plant closure. According to Deed's website, the listing of dislocated worker providers, none of them are within that 50-mile radius. So there's amount of time that's gone on here since this closure has been announced that Deed's been working through the process, yet there's no other service provider qualified to support this layoff, according to their policy. So I think we're spending a lot of time trying to figure out who the provider should be versus focusing on getting work done with this group.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to just mention our Representative Tysa is here as a co-author of the bill, and our Representative Howell on your committee is also a co-author as well. And members, I'd appreciate your support of this bill for this very unfortunate plant closure in our community, and I'd take questions.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? I think Dave wants to come down and... So we have a testifier from Deed coming down. So, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is May Tao-Shuk, and I am the Department of Employment and Economic Development, or Deed's Director of Employment and Training Programs. Hello, Tammy. Good to see you here. I am here today to discuss the state rapid response process and to provide feedback in the House File 4342. As you know, on January 30th, 2018, Electrolux announced that they were closing their St. Cloud plant permanently by the end of 2020. This closure will have a devastating, again, impact on almost 900 workers, which I think you heard about, and their families, along with the St. Cloud community. Deed is committed to working with the community in Electrolux to assist in lessening the impact by transitioning workers to other suitable employment and education opportunities. Since the announcement, Deed has been working with the Electrolux and also the City of St. Cloud to develop clear next steps. Deed staff is currently wrapping up our collection of process and employee surveys, which counselors will also help to identify the best course of actions for job service or retraining opportunities. In effort to capitalize on all of the available resources, Deed staff filed a trade adjustment assistance petition, which could also provide additional federal funding for employees as well. The following is just a summary of our process for implementing our state dislocated worker programs. So step one, which conduct, again, an initial on-site meeting with the employer, which we have already completed. That is the time that we meet the employer management group, union leaders to learn the details of the layoff, and then also to offer any layoff aversions options. Step two, we have just completed today as well. The state rapid response team has 7 meetings at Electrolux, again, on April 3rd and 4th, and we collected over 690 surveys, with 83 employees indicated that they wanting interpreter services and also translated materials as well during that time. Electrolux is collecting surveys for any of the individuals that were not present at the meetings, and those are being handled today. The survey is used to assess workers' education, job search needs, such as their education level, their hours worked, years of service, wages, and et cetera. This information will be shared with the selected dislocated worker service provider. That way, again, counselors can advise the workers of the best course of action for job searches or retraining efforts. During these meetings to the team, the team will also recruit, again, volunteers to be a part of the planning and selection committee who will choose the dislocated worker service provider. Again, the planning and also selection committee are chosen from those who volunteer and also represent the diverse makeup of the workforce. So that's our second step. Our third step, the planning and selection committee will then meet. Under guidance of our team, the planning and selection committee identifies workers' needs, how they match the services that are offered by the service providers competing in their project. The committee chooses the dislocated worker provider programs to deliver services to employees facing the layoff. Step four, what we do is the committee and provider refine a grant proposal together. While services are underway, the committee and the service provider will collaborate on a grant process to the state, and then the grant will pay for the provider's service. We approve the grant in order for the provider to be paid. In addition, the state rapid response team procedures designed to get services directly to the workers quickly. The team works closely with our local partners and economic development as well about how to best transition workers into suitable employment as quickly as possible after the layoff. Moreover, the state rapid response team is also available to support, again, community strategies, and then also to share best practices from other communities as needed during this time. The goal is to do as much as possible to support the St. Cloud community continuously and look for resources to provide and also assist assistance to workers in the entire community as a whole. So with respect to the House File 4342, we support Representative Knobloch's, again, leadership and also your commitment to assist his community as they navigate this very critical situation. We are committed to working with him on the bill. Would like to provide some details on a number of policies, timing, and also technical issues.
In the House file 4342, which I will go ahead and just outline for you. So some of the issues that we see with the bill is circumvents the employee-driven process. The bill chooses a provider for employees instead of empowering the employees to really choose their own service provider based on worker needs and the services offered by the service providers. When the project is deemed competitive, the current process is to have a planning and selection committee comprised of employees, again, really choose the dislocated provider program services to deliver services to employees facing the layoff. The bill further sets a precedent for all of service providers to circumvent the employee-driven process and instead request earmark funding from legislator. This could cause a variety of funding complications for the layoff. For the layoff earmarked, and then particularly in our economic downturn. To that end, there have been a number of mass layoffs announced this year throughout the state. For example, Bellagio Food in Austin, LK Manufacturing in New Ulm, and also Bonton Stores, Herberger in Duluth, and also the Twin Cities here. So Deed has received over 40 mass layoffs since January 1, 2018, which really impacts about 4,000 people potentially, and our ability to service employees with sufficient funding could be impacted by a process of earmarking funding for particular layoffs. The other issue is funding levels and also multiple service providers. Based on our estimates, the funding allocated in this bill is inadequate to serve the employees at Electrolux, and the bill's legislative intent seems to serve Electrolux employees as well as employees in related industry affected by its closure. So this likely funding shortfall could have a number of impacts. It could lead to two service providers that are serving this layoff, one funded by the earmark and one funded through a competitive employee-driven process. It could also lead to Career Solutions receiving two grants award, one following the appropriation language and then one following the dislocated worker statute, which differ in a number of significant ways. Finally, the dislocated worker statute provides flexibility, which allows for modification to the grants after the initial allocation. But the legislative language provides no such flexibility, potentially causing implications in the future. Another issue is that it creates, services timing gap. Bill language requires the delivery of service to affected workers before December 31, 2018, which is at the latest, again, on line 1.15. The company anticipates a closure to occur in late Q4 of 2019 and then Q1 of 2020, which creates a gap over a year between when the delivery of service funded by this bill are rendered and employees are likely to be laid off. The other issue is that the bill's technical challenges, so line 1.14 requiring application of federal waivers, there seems to be some confusion between the state and also the federal dislocated worker programs. In relation to this bill, the state dislocated worker requirements are established in state statute and policy. Waiving the eligibility requirements could happen administratively with approval of the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. There are at least two other instances of this occurring in the past for several long lead layoff. Therefore, no federal waiver is actually needed to provide the services under this legislation. And then related languages, again, line 1.110 and 1.111 in the bill earmarks funds for Electrolux plant and in related industry affected by its closure. Typically, we service workers in mass layoffs as a project. So Electrolux would be their own project. Any subsequent industries that had layoff would be serviced as they announce layoff as individual projects. Typically, again, we do not do community impact grants. Under this bill, we would need more specific parameters around related industry to define that language.
Again, as stated, Deed is committed to working with Electrolux, the employees, their families, and certainly in the St. Cloud community to lessen the impact of this closure. We look forward to working with you. And then to this end, and encourage you to reach out to me if you have any questions about our state rapid response process or activities. We look forward to hearing from you further to assist the St. Cloud community. So I want to personally say thank you, and I'm really happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you. Before we do that, is there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the member questions and comments. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Knobloch. I have a few questions. I mean, the economy in general in the U.S. is not in the slump. I mean, there's a lot of jobs, a lot of companies that are expanding. In fact, I think Electrolux decided in January to invest $500 million in expanding its U.S. operations. Unfortunately, they just decided to do it in a state that had lower taxes and lower regulations. And that sounds like what they've been done in closing the plant in St. Cloud. I noticed on March 2nd, they announced they were going to withhold about $250 million in investments because of the steel tariffs. Do you know if this has impacted their decision to continue closing the plant?
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Munson. No, the steel tariffs came about after the decision to close the plant was made, and so that really didn't have anything to do with the closing of the plant. The issues you talk about in terms of taxation and the state's business climate certainly may have been issues as to why the plant when its operations are going to be moved to South Carolina, but that's obviously not the subject of this bill.
Sure. Representative Munson.
This question is more for Deed. I hear a lot about there's more jobs that are available in Minnesota than there are people looking for jobs. Is there some type of matching that goes on with companies that are looking for workers with this list? Have you reached out to companies that are looking for large groups of workers to see even if there's potential for, you know, busing them to another city for temporarily to seek employment that way, or are you relying on the workers to look for jobs on their own through your website and such?
Mm-hmm. To the testifier.
Okay, great. Mr. Chair and Representative, we do work with our partner, our economic development representative, and then we also have all of the workforce centers as well. So we actively and consistently work with employers, and we, again, really look for partnership. And so once we have the surveys, we start doing those things, and we start working with the service providers to ensure that, again, they have the tools that they need.
Representative Munson.
Okay. And then, for Deed, you mentioned that there were all of these mass layoffs so far this year. Do you have an idea of the length of time that similar workers have been unemployed?
To the testifier.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative. We do have timing in terms of some of those. I can say that they range all the way from, again, April 14th all the way through July 15th. So it's a range at this point.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Okay. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Knobloch, just wondering how you arrived at the 650,000 number.
Representative Knobloch.
Representative Scott. Let me first say that in regard to some of the concerns of Deed, you know, it probably would be appropriate to put in something like no less than $650,000 in there. But it was conversations I had with Tammy Deary and Career Solutions on what they thought was needed to really jumpstart the project.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And are any of the, I believe it says 900 jobs that are going to be lost, are any of those going to South Carolina in the move, or are those were all were just
Representative Scott, as far as I know, no. None of them are being transferred to South Carolina.
All right, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, just to one question of Representative Munson's regarding this whole issue of the full economy. Yes, we are fortunate that we are in a situation that, the economy is doing better than it often has. But you know, in regard to, you know, first of all, the money that's being used here, of course, it is dislocated worker fund money. It's not general fund money. I mean, this is the purpose for which dislocated worker fund money should be going. So I think it's appropriate that we use that money set aside for a purpose such as this. And secondly, you know, this is unlike a lot of other layoffs. I mean, there aren't any other freezer manufacturers in Minnesota that these people can go get jobs at. I mean, we only have one freezer manufacturing plant in Minnesota that I'm aware of, the one in St. Cloud. And so many of these people are have positions that are really quite specialized, and their skills aren't necessarily easily transferable to other jobs.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Knobloch. Although Electrolux is a freezer manufacturer, we have a very robust HVAC industry in our state, and many of those skills are transferable. You're correct, though there are likely to be some that would not. My question is for the testifier. So you said there was 4,000 layoffs that have happened. People have been laid off this year or are coming in the future?
To the testifier.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We have had 4,000, or again, in terms of organizations that have notified us, there are potentially 4,000 employees that will be impacted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
What is your average cost of a laid-off worker to help? Do you have that number?
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative, I can give you my best estimate. We estimate it roughly 4,000 per impacted employee.
Representative Mahoney.
So that'll be about $16 million, I think. Mr. Chair, if I might ask fiscal staff.
Sure.
Could you tell me if you know what is left in the dislocated workers fund at the present time?
Mr. Zempel, do you have the balance of the dislocated worker program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, can I get just a moment?
Do you have another question while we're waiting, Representative Mahoney?
Well, I'm building my case.
Oh, okay, all right.
I can say this, Mr. Chair. It was nice to hear Representative Knobloch talk about what this money is used for, because we have used it for other purposes. Maybe had a wavy path to get to that purpose, but that's where we drew the money from. And my concern is we continue to take money from the workforce development funds and workers retraining funds and seem to think that it's a never-ending supply of money. It's very frustrating and very worrisome for me because we have in the past run out of money in that particular fund. And the good fortune was that we were in session and we could address that and pump another $10 million into that out of general funds. But we're unlikely to be in session when and if money was to run out in that. And I don't know that people would want to call a special session to help people in December or November or October.
Well, I'll wait for fiscal staff.
Is that right? Sorry, Mr. Zempel, my recollection was $26 million, am I right?
Mr. Chair, $21,482,000 at the end of fiscal 17.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And at the end of fiscal 17, when does fiscal 17 end?
June 30th, 2017.
And to the testifier, have we had any layoffs since then? That we've had to spend money on?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to give you those numbers after or, oh, okay. Sorry, there we go. So sorry about that. So let me go ahead and I will give you the information that I have for the Workforce Development Fund balance. It's, again, we have Electrolux 900 employees, and then I'm just going to look through my, so we have Electrolux right here with 900. I'm just looking. We have had, again, DaVita 53, Sun Country 900. This Sun Country Airlines 350, Verizon Call Center in Mankato 600, LK Manufacturing 113, Montan Stores, which is Herberger's and also Yonkers, Metro Duluth 650 employees.
So,
Representative Mahoney.
So is that 650 since the start of the fiscal year? Because fiscal staff says there's 21 million. And if we've had another 2,000 layoffs, that probably drags that down. I am not going to beat up on the Ways and Means Chair's city or his particular bill. But I want people to understand that we should not be taking money out of this except for retraining of employees. And we do it all the time. And we are in danger of being, we will not have any rollover next year. And I am very, very concerned. And we seem to think this is a piggy bank that we could just take money out of. But it is, as Representative Knobloch said, this is a tax to employers on the wages that they pay their employees in order to cover layoffs. It's a compact we make with employers. And we don't seem to think that we should have to keep that particular compact. This, at least, is going to workers that are being laid off, although I think it's going a bit beyond that. It's really problematic. I've said my piece on it. I am, again, concerned that we're going to take money out of this fund again, probably a little early, but that's what I have to say.
Representative Knobloch, any closing comments?
Well, sure. Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, I wonder if I could ask Mr. Zempel a question myself, and that is, I mean, how much money per year comes into this fund? We've heard about money going out, but there's obviously money coming in as well.
So, Mr. Zempel, if maybe if you want to cover the workforce development fee and what goes, just kind of give a high-level overview of everything. So,
well, all I need is how much money comes in a year.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, in fiscal 18, we're expecting $55.841 million in addition to the $21.482 million that balanced forward.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess I just want to make my point that, yes, there have been layoffs. Yes, we are expending money in this fund, but obviously there's also significant money coming into the fund. And so, members, I guess to close, I first of all want to thank the work that Deed has done on this.
Well, all right. Okay. Well, why don't we let Representative Mahoney say that, and then we always give the author the opportunity to close. Representative Mahoney.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Temple. How much money did we take out of the workforce fund for in spending that was not directed to layoffs last year? My recollection is we were in the $30 million range or better.
Mr. Zempel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, in fiscal 17, we directly appropriated $30 million to the Department of Employment and Economic Development and about $1.5 million to Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you.
Fiscal year 18.
For fiscal year 18, we directly appropriated $35.6 million to DEED and just over $2 million to labor and industry.
So Mr. Chair, to Representative Knobloch, I understand as the Ways and Means Chair, you work at a higher level than the fiscal committees. But in the weeds, again, we took half to better
for this this money for purposes that only have a tangential way of getting to workforce. And we continue to take money out of this. Again, the $650,000 is kind of a drop in the bucket for what we spend out of this. The Department of obviously is very concerned. But understand that we take a bunch of money out of this. It's not $70 million, Wayne. There's $76 million. It really gets down to like $30 million. And it's a good thing that right now we are in a robust economy. But Mr. Trump and his devastation of what he's going to do to the farm countries and to the meat processing companies and a variety of others in this state, we have some choppy waters ahead of us, and we have now 25, 50, or 100 agencies that are expecting money out of this. And they've been getting money out of this at some level for a good number of years. When this takes, the businesses of Minnesota expect us to fulfill our part of the bargain by taking money from them and training workers. And somebody's not going to be happy.
Representative Knobloch, you get the final word.
Okay, well, I guess, first of all, in response to Representative Mahoney, I mainly wanted to show that, A, there is money coming into this fund as well, significant amounts of money coming into the fund, and it seemed like there was some concern as to whether $650,000 was going to be too much for the fund to take, but in Representative Mahoney's own words, it's a drop in the bucket. I believe that we do need to make sure that we take care of dislocated workers, and I'm certainly committed to doing that. I understand that, you know, some of the purposes that the funds have been used for have been more directly tied to dislocated workers, whereas some has been not as directly tied. But in regard to this particular bill, this is obviously a bill that deals with dislocated workers. If there's any funding stream that would be appropriate for these people would be the Dislocated Workers Fund. And so again, I want to close by, first of all, just I do want to thank Deed. I know they've been working hard on it. I want to just briefly respond to a couple of things they mentioned. This issue of specifically naming a provider, as you heard from Ms. Veery, there is no other provider eligible underneath Deed guidelines. So why are we wasting time in getting help to these people when we're going to end up picking career solutions when it's all done? I guess I did write the bill, even though Deed is working on it, partly because I do want to make sure this happens. There have been some other non-dislocated worker fund issues where I've expected to be getting grants in our community from Deed for other purposes that haven't happened, and this is such a critical issue that I did want to make sure it was named and that Electrolux in my community and the people that are being affected are going to be taken care of. In regard to the comment that we have a timing gap, if you look at page 1, line 15, it simply says we need to begin providing services to affected workers by December 31st, 2018. It doesn't say we have to spend all the money by then and that then there's not going to be any money available to people after that date. That's not the case. And I guess finally, to the extent there are technical issues that Deed sees around the bill, I'm certainly committed to working with them so that we can take care of the workers that are being affected by this in my and Representative Tice's and Jeff Howe's communities. And so with that, appreciate your consideration, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Knobloch. And with that, the Chairman is his motion to have House File 4342 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Knobloch, House File 2112 is next on the agenda. And thank you to Deed for their feedback as well. Chair will move House File 2112 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Knobloch, to your bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, thanks for taking all the time for Jim Knobloch today. We've got a couple of important bills, though. I mean, the Electrolux bill is important. And House File 2112 is an important bill, too. You heard this bill last year. This bill changes the allocation of how the state can use its tax-exempt bonding authority we get from the federal government so we can build some more affordable housing. And there is a rather long amendment, the DE4 amendment, I'd like added on, Mr. Chair. What it basically does, maybe you can move it first, what's technically before us.
It's members of the chair will move the DE4 amendment, and members, the research summary that's in your packet conforms to the DE4 amendment, not to the original language, so that, your overview is in that. Is there any questions about getting the bill in the form that the author would like and conforming it to the research summary? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The DE4 amendment is adopted. Representative Knobloch, to your bill as amended.
Okay. Mr. Chair, currently the state gets about $550 million a year in tax-exempt housing bonding authority from the federal government. These are not GO bonds or trunk highway bonds, federal guaranteed bonds. Although a portion is allocated to help single-family home buyers, this portion has not been completely used in recent years because mortgage rates on single-family homes have been so competitive. What this bill would do is take a portion of those single-family home funds, about $56 million per year, and use them for construction of affordable multifamily housing projects. Since there's significant matching money available for these sorts of funds underneath federal tax credit programs like Section 42, this would allow construction of affordable housing many times the $56 million in bonding authority that's allocated. The amendment that is before you limited the effects of this bill to 2 years so that if the mortgage market changes, we can go back to making sure that we aren't disadvantaging those people. Remember, there's a few other things as well that have been generally agreed upon by the affordable housing community in the state. It prioritized projects that use 55% of their less. It prioritizes projects that use 55% or less of their funding with bonds so that more total projects can be funded. It increases the priority of projects that are oriented toward lower income residents for a longer term. It distributes funds when more than 100% of the funding is requested on a random basis rather than a pro rata basis. And that's so that if you do it on a pro rata basis, you run into problems where some projects simply can't be done because they didn't get enough money. Delaying projects, this would make sure that projects do in fact get done. And it gives communities that have a need for low-income senior housing greater access to these housing bonds. And Mr. Chair, I have with me Owen Metz with the Dominion Corporation, a large affordable housing provider, to speak in support of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and for those who are wondering, Max Kepler hit his third home run for the game. The Twins win 9-8 over the Houston Astros in the bottom of the ninth inning. So, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Owen Metz. Thanks for the opportunity to speak again. I was here last session in support of Representative Knobloch's bill as well, so appreciate you considering housing policy. Dominion is an affordable housing provider. As Representative Knobloch mentioned, we've been doing this for 45 straight years. We have about 300 employees in Minnesota and about 1,000 across the country, which makes us the largest provider of affordable housing in Minnesota and the second largest in the country. So this is our backyard, and we're interested in seeing more get done with the federal resource that we have. Just to give a little bit of a highlight of who we serve, of the 7,000 housing units that we have in Minnesota, the vast majority of those have been financed with private activity bonds, this federal resource, and most importantly, the 4% long-term housing tax credit that brings in significant private investment into Minnesota. And the residents that we serve earn on average about $27,000 a year per household. So we're serving very low-income residents who really need help in getting a place to live and to afford. And of our residents, about 70% of them as a household earn less than $45,000 a year, which is below 50% of area median income. So it's really serving folks that have incomes that have been stagnant, that work in the service industry, that have a hard time affording nice, quality, safe housing. Chapter 474A hasn't been updated in almost 20 years, and it allocates one of the two primary federal resources that we get as a state to do do affordable housing, and mainly the tax-exempt bonds. And in that 20-year history since this last received major updates, the market for tax-exempt bonds has changed significantly. Interest rates have changed significantly. And really the tax-exempt benefit that interest provides is very nominal now. And so the main benefit of using this federal resource is to bring the tax credit with it. That's the only way as a state we can build this type of affordable housing is with the tax credit. We need the bonds first and then get the tax credit. As you know, Minnesota is a state. In 20 years, we've got an ever-growing senior population. The current law effectively has a bias against seniors and makes them a lower priority. You know, incomes have remained flat, as I mentioned, which has furthered the affordable housing crisis that we have as a state. And we're just not building enough affordable housing. Compared to Colorado, a similar size state, we build something like half of the affordable housing that they build with the same federal resource that Colorado gets in almost the same size. So this would kind of modernize the state and allow it to produce more affordable housing and produce more economic development and tax base in our state. I think the main goal is to drive that economic development, drive affordable housing, and do it in a way that not only adds jobs and tax base, but really provides needed affordable housing. Representative Knobloch mentioned a lot of the things it accomplishes, but really want to just finish with, this isn't pitting single family against multifamily. This is using a federal resource that we get, tax-exempt bonds, and saying, do we want to save a little bit of interest rate when we borrow money tax-exempt to purchase single-family mortgages so that Minnesota Housing can make money? Or as a state, do we want to say, let's take this federal resource and build a lot of affordable housing? Every $100 million of bonds can produce 800 to 1,000 units of affordable housing. It will generate $50 to $60 million of private investment into Minnesota. Compared to the interest rate savings over a 16-year period, present value that Minnesota Housing would make is about $4 million. It's night and day, the amount of investment and the amount of economic development, and most importantly, the amount of affordable housing. We as a state, as policymakers, you have an opportunity to bring this statute current and allow it to take advantage of the financial times that we have and as an industry to build a lot of affordable housing. So with that, it's a very technical bill. Happy to answer questions and give our thoughts on it as an affordable housing provider here in Minnesota. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And we'll complete public testimony before we move on to member questions. Next on the list I have is a Tom Hansen. Is that who you wish to speak?
I don't think he wanted to speak.
Okay. Do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not.
Okay. Next is Commissioner Tinglethal. Welcome back, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Knobloch. I want to start out by saying that shortly you will hear from, and my name is Mary Tengerthal, Commissioner at Minnesota Housing. Shortly you will hear from some subsequent speakers that represent a working group of housing stakeholders that worked over the course of last summer and last fall after we discussed this bill during the last session, and agree to five consensus items which are reflected in the amendment that Representative Knobloch has brought forward today. And I do want the committee to know that on those five items of the seven that are included in the bill, in the amendment, with some technical changes which we've informed group about, we believe those changes could have a very positive impact on the way that bonds are allocated and used in the state and will in fact produce additional rental housing. And it's something that the administration could support on those five items. I want to thank Representative Knobloch for bringing those items forward. He encouraged us, in fact, last spring to work together on the different opinions that you heard last spring, and I really am pleased that we were able to reach consensus on so many of those items. That said, there are two items that are included in the bill that were debated by the group where we tried to reach consensus and were unable to reach consensus, and those are the two items I'd like to talk about today. First of all, a new issue that was not brought forth in the bill last year is in Section 1 of the amendment, and it begins on line 1.24. What this language says is that projects that simply received an allocation of tax-exempt bond and authority would be automatically deemed to have satisfied all of the requirements of Minnesota Housing's Qualified Allocation Plan. Now, as Mr. Metz mentioned, this is a very technical bill, but what I will tell you is that we are required, every state is required by federal law exercising our duties in allocating federal low-income housing tax credits to develop a qualified allocation plan. It's a plan that we bring forward every year. We bring it out in draft form. It is subject to a significant amount of public comment. And I honestly think that in the 30 years of the low-income housing tax credit, it's been one of the best features of this federal law, because it does allow each state to fine-tune the allocation of this scarce resource of low-income housing tax credits to projects that meet the priorities of the state. We try not to make a lot of changes from year to year. It's something that is presented to the public. We take public testimony. We encourage public testimony. And it's adopted by the board of directors of the Housing Finance Agency. And then it is signed off on by the governor of the state. So it is a very public process, and there are opportunities each year. What the language that's included in the amendment would do is override that very public process on how these so-called 4% tax credits would be allocated. And we honestly think that that is not only a mistake, but would put the state out of compliance with federal law. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. It is a new issue that wasn't discussed last session, and one that we feel very strongly about. It's not only a question of the allocation plan, but we have other duties about reporting on all of the projects that receive allocations of credits, whether they're ones that come with an allocation of bonds or if they're ones that are competitively allocated. And one of those issues, which frankly we added to the qualified allocation plan last year, was that projects that are allocated credits must meet a cost reasonable test. And we know that both this body and the Senate are very concerned about the cost reasonableness of affordable housing. And right now, if you were to include this language, it would remove any test of what the cost per unit would be, as opposed to our qualified allocation plan, which does have a requirement in that regard. So happy to answer questions when the time is right, but I wanted you to be concerned about, to know about our very serious concern. The second portion that we would not like included in the bill, should it move forward, is found in lines 6.7 and 6.8. As Representative Knobloch pointed out, this would remove the set-aside for the so-called city's participation program for a period of 2 years. And we do appreciate that Representative Knobloch has limited it to 2 years, but we really feel that this period of continuing low interest rates is exactly the time frame in which we should have the city's participation program. It was represented that, you know, do you want to make a choice of Minnesota Housing making money, or do you want to build more rental units? I really think that's a false choice. And what I do want to point out is that the primary use that Minnesota Housing does with the earnings that it's able to, the greater earnings that it's able to make by the issuance of tax exempt in combination with taxable bonds and recycled bonds, is that last year alone we made $25 million available to 4,000 first-time home buyers in the form of down payment and closing cost assistance. We find that's the biggest gap for first-time home buyers. They have jobs, they can afford to make a mortgage payment, but with the very tight competition in the single-family mortgage market, they do need that down payment and closing cost assistance. And that's what we're able to accomplish by continuing to use a modest amount of the tax-exempt bonding authority for single-family as opposed to rental housing. I would also say that since we became aware that this was becoming a scarce resource, we have worked very hard at Minnesota Housing to really squeeze the most out of the limited amount of tax-exempt bonding authority we use for single family. We typically include about $1 of tax-exempt financing together with $1 of taxable financing together with $1 of recycled bonding authority that if we couldn't use it for single family would go unused. So we're trying to be good stewards of that resource, and our estimates out of the $550 million that Representative Knobloch talked about that we have available every year is that about 67% of that $550 million will, going forward, if this change is not made, be used for rental housing, and about 33% would be used for single family. So, Happy, I know that you'll hear from others about this, but I wanted you to know about our two concerns with the amendment as it is presented.
Thank you, Commissioner. Our next testifier is Barb Dacey. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Barbara Dacey. I'm the Executive Director for the Washington County Community Development Agency. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Knobloch. I also am the Legislative Chair for the Minnesota Chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, representing 150 agencies across the state of Minnesota. Minnesota NARO opposes the provision contained in House File 2112 that removes the set-aside of 31% of the housing pool for single-family housing programs. This set-aside provides the bonding authority for the Minnesota City's participation program and helps address the financing needs for statewide first-time homebuyer programs. These first-time homebuyer programs provide at or below market rate home mortgage loans and down payment assistance for low and moderate income homebuyers. We oppose removing the set-aside for four reasons. First, communities across the state see this tool as a way to attract young families to put down community roots. Homeowners contribute to the economic ripple effect of supporting schools, businesses, and the local economy. So eliminating the set-aside essentially eliminates the public-private partnership that communities want and need. The partnership leverages federal and state funds with the resources of local banks and the lenders that serve first-time homebuyers. Second, in 2017, over 1,800 families across the state used the Minnesota City's participation program as a pathway to home ownership. 38 cities and counties statewide rely on this program. It's administered by local community banker and lenders and is oversubscribed by over 500%. So last year alone, 993 families have been served in the metro area, and 848 families were served in greater Minnesota. Third, the statute as is now written preserves the housing market ecosystem. The housing market relies on the synergy between the churn in the rental and home ownership markets, and the existing language and set-aside strikes a good balance. So eliminating the single-family programs makes it harder for families to become homeowners, which then creates additional need for rental units. Moreover, if the bonding authority is only used for rental housing, Greater Minnesota would see the biggest negative impact from our point of view, because the new rental developments typically require a larger scale, and they would probably most likely locate in the metro area. And finally, the statute as now written increases homeownership opportunities. The programs are crucial to the state's policy to increase homeownership opportunities and as a means to reduce the racial disparities in homeownerships. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier is Ellen Solly. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ellen Sally. I'm president of the Family Housing Fund. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Knobloch. Thank you for the opportunity to appear in front of this committee. The Family Housing Fund is a 35-year-old nonprofit organization helping communities address their affordable housing needs. And complementing your investment, we have invested more than $235 million of private investments in affordable housing, from shelter to rental housing through home ownership. Last year, I appeared in front of this committee and testified against the bill. In my testimony, I highlighted that there was not consensus between the housing stakeholders about the impact of this proposal. I encouraged the committee to reject the proposal, and I committed to working with the various stakeholders in an attempt to craft a compromise that would ensure the full range of housing choices in the state. I want to recognize Representative Knobloch's leadership on this important issue. We are all keenly aware of the critical lack of affordable housing throughout the state. And despite my objection to this specific bill last session, his leadership sparked an important conversation and discussion within the housing community about how a program could work better. So thank you for that. However, today I'm here to present a case for an alternative and to proceed with only components of this bill that has broad-based consensus within the affordable housing community. Efficiency and effectiveness with public resources is essential, and it allows us to tackle many of the community and policy and public policy priorities. As I pledged last fall, my colleagues Warren Hansen from the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, who you'll hear from in a minute, Ann Mavity from the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I convened a 15-member steering team representing the various perspectives on how the state uses the tax-exempt bonding authority. Rental developers and proponents of House File 2112, proponents of affordable housing, home ownership, and the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing were included in part of the steering team. And over nine meetings of this group, two larger stakeholder meetings, and a survey of the broader housing community, we hammered out consensus language of 5 points that are incorporated in Representative Knobloch's bill. And we agreed on the following 5 points, tax-exempt bonding only impacting rental housing. Briefly, and as Representative Knobloch already highlighted in parts of in his presentation, we agreed on limiting the bond use to 55% of eligible uses. We agreed on establishing new priorities for projects with longer-term affordability and deeper affordability, and in communities and counties with lower average incomes, such as exist in Greater Minnesota. We agreed on including senior housing as a higher priority. We agreed to replace partial funding of projects with a random selection to enable projects to move forward quicker. And we finally agreed on the discouraging parking of bonds that would enable shovel-ready projects to move quickly. We did not reach an agreement on all points, and when we didn't reach an agreement, we are not proposing a change to the statute at this time. But I'm pleased to say that all members of our steering team and the larger community agreed on these 5 points, and I strongly encourage this committee to advance the legislation that's limited only to these points. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Warren Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd also like to, my name is Warren Hansen. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and I'd also like to acknowledge Representative Knobloch's leadership and his encouragement to work toward an agreement among the affordable housing practitioners and organizations, nonprofits and for-profits, and public agencies in Minnesota. And as Ellen Solly pointed out, we did conduct that process, convened the process. It took a couple of dozen meetings and 5 months of various considerations and discussions that resulted in the 5 points of agreement. And I am here also speaking from Greater Minnesota Housing Fund's perspective to ask the members to consider preserving the single-family set-aside. It is important to single-family home buyers in Greater Minnesota. About 45% of the resources that the agency generates from the tax-exempt bonds and the issuance of these mortgages is used in Greater Minnesota. So there is a demand in Greater Minnesota for the single-family mortgages, and there is a demand in Greater Minnesota for the down payment assistance. And I would point out that it's, from our perspective, very pleasing to realize that Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is able to generate revenue to provide the down payment assistance, and through the tax exempt bond program actually create a win-win situation where tax exempt bonds are used to issue the mortgages and revenues are generated to provide that essential down payment and entry cost assistance for first-time home buyers. Also, I think that if you are catching the headlines in the last couple of weeks, the United States and Minnesota in particular right now is suffering a single-family home shortage for all home buyers seeking to own a home, and this does make it possible for more home buyers to afford to purchase a home and stimulates that market. And the affordability of a single family home in Greater Minnesota can be roughly equal to renting, and so this is a good moment to continue to support single family home owners who need a little bit of assistance to become successful first time home buyers. And the last thing I'll say is that it's important also to realize that local units of government and public agencies and organizations throughout the state elect to use this program, ask the Housing Finance Agency for an allocation of these resources for single-family home buyers. And this is really a ground-up or, you know, a local community demand that is being satisfied to help local communities foster home ownership and support the needs of these first-time home buyers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, I've been informed that we actually lose this committee room at 4:50. Mm-hmm. So if you're here for House File 4095, the Nash bill, that's going to get postponed until the first bill on the agenda tomorrow. So we're not going to hear that. But we do, the chair's intent to get through this bill as well as the two Gunther bills and the Mahoney bill before 4:50. So with that, is there any additional public testimony on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion, move to member questions and comments. Representative Munson and then Moran. Representative Munson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my initial question was had to do with the reprioritization of handouts to developers over the first home buyers, but I think that's been answered with the last testimony. But I do have a question for Ms. Tingerthal about the single family home down payment assistance. And is there a percentage of these the down payment assistance that's actually forgiven, or is this money paid back all the time, except for kind of the when it's foreclosed on?
And Representative Munson, do you have any other questions, or is that a
in the interest of time, I guess that would just be the main question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Munson, we provide two different kinds of down payment assistance. One is in the form of a deferred loan that's recorded as a lien on the property, and when that property is sold, those are repaid dollar for dollar. The other type is an amortizing loan for those borrowers who have a little higher income. We actually get repayments over a 10-year period, so it's fully repaid with interest over a period of 10 years.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, sir. But none of the down payment assistance is actually forgiven. It's all paid back. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Munson, that is correct.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have several questions, so be patient with me for a little bit to try to better understand this bill.
You have been gone for a while.
I need to catch up.
Representative Moran, just again, we have a hard stop at 4:50.
Okay.
So I don't have any discretion to go beyond that.
Okay,
so
I won't go that long. So
well, I'm hoping you're not going to go through <I'm> saying.
Representative Knobloch, I just want to thank you for focusing on affordable housing. I think it's really, really important that that is something that we do. We definitely are not building enough, and nor do we have enough affordable housing available. So my first, and let me just state that today is a very important day. For those who do not know, it's a history moment that 50 years ago today, the Fair Housing Act was signed into law. Just want to just raise that up because we still need that, right? So in your opening statement, you talked about that there is unused money.
Yes.
It has not been used for a single family home, so you're taking $56 million away from that per year. What is that dollar amount that has been gone unused? Is there anyone who can answer that?
Representative Knobloch, did you want to answer, or do you want to phone a friend?
Well, I may ask Mr. Metz to come forward, but I think, maybe what I should say, Representative Moran, is that we're proposing to use the money more efficiently. I mean, what Minnesota Housing is doing right now is, to a large extent, taking that money and arbitraging it and using the earnings to help with some of this down payment assistance for single-family home buyers. We think that, frankly, I mean, Minnesota Housing, I can get into this more, Minnesota Housing has other capital that they could do that with if they wished, but then being able to use this capital, we'd be able to leverage it and build a lot more affordable housing and still be able to serve those other people, too.
You wish to add any context? Restate your name for the club.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, Owen Metz with Dominion. Bonds have been oversubscribed the last couple years, so before that they were underutilized. But with lower interest rates and tax credit pricing where it is, there's been strong demand on the rental side to actually produce affordable housing, and that's where they've become oversubscribed in the last couple years.
Representative Moran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I heard you say it, so it has not been used for single-family home or on affordable housing site?
Mr. Metz?
Madam Chair, Representative. Trying to think too fast and not think. It has been used for single-family. It just was undersubscribed on rental family. So Minnesota Housing has been using the vast majority of the bonds that they've received to do what Representative Knobloch described, is arbitraging that to make additional revenue for the agency. It's been recently where the rental side has been able to actually utilize it to build housing. That's a recent thing in the economy where low interest rates and tax credit pricing has allowed that.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. So help me understand a little bit better. So there's a group, some housing leaders who got together, and this is part of your bill, these five initiatives that is included in your bill. The question I have is, will increased priority for projects with deeper affordability, lower terms, and located in counties with lower average incomes, Greater Minnesota. Do that mean that in building affordable housing, that we're only going to focus on Greater Minnesota, or what do we mean by having this in here like that?
Well, Representative Knobloch, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, this was part of the sort of overall affordable housing stakeholder agreement. No, we're still going to be building affordable housing in the metro area. What we're trying to do is to say that we're going to try to target these bonds towards lower income people. There are different standards as you do these projects. Some of the projects are eligible for renters that make 60% or less of the average county median income. Some of them are for those that make 30% or less. We're talking about targeting these for the, in some cases, lower income people than have been in the past.
Representative Moran?
Yes, thank you. So just for clarity, we know that those people exist in the urban core too, right?
Yes.
So that will be a target area.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you for that. So I do just wanted to share that part of me just need to state the importance of home ownership, and that that we continue to make that a focus and a priority, especially for like low-income communities, communities of color, who's underrepresented of wealth, and that is a way of accumulating that wealth, and we're still needed, and it is still needed. So I'm just wondering, does your bill just like totally eliminate that process for municipal housing to invest in single-family homes.
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I think Minnesota Housing still would have the ability to help the people that you're talking about buy homes.
Representative Moran.
So if you don't mind, if I could help the commissioner to...
Commissioner Chingafalk, you can come down. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, this, can you just help me better understand the impact that this bill will have on the ability for individuals to have the support to buy a single-family home?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, our concern is that without this $56 million, and I have to again say, for every dollar of tax-exempt bonding authority, we use other unrestricted bonding authority to issue roughly $150 million worth of bonding. So last year, we provided about $600 million worth of financing. So without this, we could be looking at a reduction down to maybe $450 million. So a reduction in the number of borrowers that we could serve.
Representative Moran.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. So again, Representative Knobloch, I do want to just say thank you for, you know, making more affordable housing available for so many people who are struggling to pay at market rate rent. It's just like impossible. But I just want to state my concern for the lack of, from what I'm hearing, the lack of the ability to focus also on home ownership, single family homes.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I could just say, first of all, I want to make sure I set the stage for this. You've heard concerns about 16 lines of this 28-page bill. So apparently there's agreement on 27 and a half pages of the 28-page bill. There's disagreement on one half of a page in two spots of this 28-page bill. And that relates to this issue as to how we're using the single-family portion of money that's coming to Minnesota Housing. Let me first say, I mean, I live in Greater Minnesota. If I thought this was going to hurt people in Greater Minnesota, I wouldn't be carrying the bill. But I think that we do have an affordable housing need in the metro area as well as Greater Minnesota, and I think this is going to help build more affordable housing in Greater Minnesota. Secondly, I have owned or managed a real estate brokerage company in Greater Minnesota for 35 years, and we used to see a lot more of this type of program once upon a time. We don't really see very much of this anymore. The mortgage market has developed to the extent that there are competitive mortgage rates out there for first-time home buyers. In fact, we just did something last year in the tax bill to help first-time home buyers as well. And so there are more resources out there for first-time home buyers than there used to be. Finally, a lot of this with Commissioner Tingerfall is really just a disagreement as to how best we can use the resources of the agency. I think that we can better leverage these first-time home buyer bond resources from the federal government in the affordable housing area, and that frankly, in a Ways and Means hearing we had a few weeks ago on Minnesota Housing, I believe they've got other resources that they could dedicate to this if they really wanted to.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, I just want to just say, to be really clear, my question, I do not believe that you're trying to hurt any market at all. Right, so I just want to just say that the reason for my question is not to say that I think that is your purpose, because it's not. But I do appreciate the time to ask the questions.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think I want to zero in on exactly maybe what Representative Moran was actually, you know, leading towards others, and I wonder if the commissioner could come back on again.
Representative Clark.
And let me say again, too, Representative Knobloch, thank you for caring about affordable housing in the way that you've been working very hard on this, and the compromise I've seen you've been making. That's great. I do have a concern, and Commissioner, I'm just wondering, one of the issues that I think might be under some of this discussion is the fact that until 4 years ago, Minnesota had the worst racial disparities in home ownership in the whole nation. Worst. Very bottom. And then we made some changes, and we said that we had to look at homeownership, racial disparities, and start changing some things. And the agency did. And the very next year, it went to 3. Then it went to 2. From the bottom. And I'm not exactly sure where you are now, but I think 5th from the bottom, okay. So that's all great. You know, we're going in the right direction, and I applaud you for that. I think, this is where some of the concern might be coming from. We need to keep getting up from the bottom on this issue of racial disparities in homeownership. It's really unconscionable. So I think if there's a way to somehow make this, look at this, even in Greater Minnesota, there's certainly many, you know, people of color, families in Greater Minnesota who could contribute to this, getting a better reputation and a better opportunity in Minnesota. So I'm just asking the commission if you want to make any comment about that, and then maybe some not, like, if we could figure out some way to kind of work together, and I'm just going to offer that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I will take this opportunity to say that we did consciously embark on a project of reaching out to households of color who in 2011 represented about 15% of the mortgages that Minnesota Housing originated, but that was a much smaller number of mortgages because at that time we were coming out of the recession and we only provided about $300 million worth of mortgages. In the past year we had doubled the total amount of mortgages and the percentage of those mortgages going to households of color had gone up to 33%, and so it was nearly triple the number of households of color that were served compared to 2010. So we've deliberately redesigned our programs, provided training for which we use some of those resources that Representative Knobloch referred to. I would also like to mention that of the $25 million that I mentioned that we provided last year for down payment assistance, not quite half of that was provided from our balance sheet, and those are the loans that are repaid on a monthly basis. So we are trying to utilize a broad range of resources that are available to the agency to really take advantage of this time when, in fact, interest rates are low, but really leveraging that resource so that we can produce the maximum amount of earnings to be able to use for down payment assistance. In years past, it was really the differential in interest rates, as you've heard from a couple of speakers, that made the difference. What really makes the difference now is down payment and closing cost assistance. And over that time period, we have worked with the mortgage industry to increase the dollar amounts that are available. And since they are all repaid, we felt it was important to get them to the level that actually allows homebuyers to get into a house in the first place.
Thank you. Just let me just comment, Mr. Chairman. So I thank you for all your work on that. And I do not put all of the concern about this or all the responsibilities, certainly in a small amount of funding available through public sources. Our mortgage industry really needs to step up and deal with this. And Representative Navarro, maybe we can talk some more about how that might be something we can work on together, because we're really, this is a private, mostly privately funded industry, and we can do better. So thank you for this leadership.
Representative Wagenius?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your testifier, Representative Knobloch. Is he still here?
Yep, he is.
Thank you. When you testified, you put an emphasis on senior housing, and I don't know where you are building senior housing, so help us out with that.
Don't get it right this time, Mr. Chair. Apologize. Representative, the senior housing, as Representative Knobloch mentioned, incomes drive what the rents before the housing can charge, which drive how much debt you can support. What I'm going to is to do bond finance transactions, they require a lot of debt. And so we have to charge the maximum rents we can charge in the program. So it tends to be areas of higher income in that 60% rent range. So it tends to be the Twin Cities, Rochester, and other regional centers that have a little higher income. So the federal program, the way it's set up, doesn't work great in rural areas. There are some improvements that recently passed that will help that.
Representative Wagenius.
Tends to be in the Twin Cities. It's a large area. Where are you talking about?
The test fire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've got about 1,500 units under construction from Apple Valley to Woodbury to Coon Rapids to Fire Lake to... It's really all over, a little less so in Minneapolis and St. Paul because there's been more of a focus on family housing. But in the suburban areas, it's primarily been in the suburban areas where affordable senior housing has been built.
Ms. McGinnis.
So I am hearing sort of our outer ring suburbs. They're not, for example, in Richfield like an inner ring suburb.
Mr. Metz.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's Crystal as well. I mean, it really is hitting anywhere. Minneapolis and St. Paul have their own bonds, so they use them how they choose. But it is hitting all suburbs, first ring, secondary, outer suburbs as well.
That brings up the issue that Representative Clark brought up. If our senior housing is in the outer reaches, that's a huge issue. We would be going backwards in that area. So I brought up Richfield in particular because it is a lower income neighborhood with many people of color. And so it does seem if we are concentrating on the outer ring, we're serving a subset, but not being as, which brings me back to the first point that was brought up, that we need a qualified allocation plan and to meet the priorities of the state. And so not having that is troubling to me. So I think that's one of the things that we need to concentrate on as we're moving forward.
So, Representative Knobloch, again, 28 pages in the amendment. The disagreement is on what portion of the bill?
No, the disagreement, as I understand it, is on page 1, lines 18, through page 2, line 2, and page 7, lines 4 through 8, and then the deleted language below it.
And Representative Knobloch, in your expert opinion, if we adopt this language, are we going to have more affordable units in the supply or less affordable units in supply than based off current law?
More, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Maquette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question, I think, might be for Mr. Metz. You might not want to get up, but it could be for Representative Knobloch. You brought up Apple Valley and senior housing. Can you just give me, how much does affordable mean in Apple Valley, the senior housing that's being built?
Mr. Metz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the affordable housing in the Twin Cities is based on the median income of the Twin Cities. So that serves a family of two is about $45,000 is the maximum. Most of our households are in the $30,000 range of how much income they have. And then the rents are around $1,000 for a one-bedroom apartment.
What does that make with?
Mr. Chair, thank you. So $1,000. So we're talking about affordable housing. And when we talk about seniors in particular, there's a lot of seniors in Apple Valley. We're building a lot of senior homes there. But they're selling their houses to move into these apartments. And if there's no one to buy them, then they can't move. And as our young population wants to buy houses, what we don't find is that our parents have wealth to give us, bequeath us, right? So we struggle with the down payments and the closing costs. So these seniors can't move out of their houses if we don't buy them, and we can't buy them if we don't have help. Mm-hmm. And so I do worry, even if it's just one line of a 28-page bill, one word in a 28-page bill can change a lot of things. And so I'm glad that you got to consensus on five things, but this is going to trouble me. I can tell you as a young person, we want to be in homes. We want to buy homes. We want to build community roots. I live in the community I was born and raised in. But if we remove this and we're not continuing to help folks, we're going to continue to have the disparities we have. We're going to continue to make sure that young people can't buy homes. So I think that you should listen to the Greater Minnesota housing folks and our commissioner on housing, because what they're saying is really important. This is very important to our state, and to make sure that my generation can continue to do what your generation got to do, which is buy homes and stay in them and have our families. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Metz, Representative Knobloch, you both have a solid understanding of the real estate market. Is there a shortage of young buyers in the market right now?
Mr. Chair, representatives. Mortgage rates are historic lows. It's a problem of finding the homes to open up. So I think this would actually help homes open up so seniors have housing stock to recycle. That's what we hear from council members and mayors all over the communities we work in, is there's not enough housing stock. We can get the financing, but there's not enough housing stock.
And I would agree with that, Mr. Chair. There are plenty of people that are young people, all sorts of people that are looking to buy houses, but there aren't as many affordable homes, single-family homes for sale. And, yeah, to the extent that this would open up some of those, that would be a good thing, too.
All right, Representative Knobloch, any closing comments? I'm confused by the debate, just so you know, just for the record. I do not understand how anyone... You brought a bill to us that more efficiently uses existing resources to provide more affordable housing, and we beat into the ground for 45 minutes why people are concerned about it. I just don't get it, but I'm new here. So, Representative Knobloch, you get the last word.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do appreciate people's questions. Again, I think what we're arguing about is one half of a page of the 28-page bill relating to the use of the housing bonds. Basically, in my experience, I don't think that these first-time home buyer programs are used as much as they could be, or as they were, rather, in the past. I think that to the extent they are used now, there are better ways of Minnesota housing providing those services and then using this money to build affordable housing, which is so badly needed. So I appreciate your support.
Thank you. The chairman uses his motion to have House File 2112 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Knobloch. Thank you to our testifiers. Representative Gunther.
Here.
Bobby G. Representative Gunther, I'm thinking that we can probably, you and Mr. Dorman can come down first, and we'll do the BDPI. Just perhaps a refresher for members on what it is. I think pretty straightforward on what your bill seeks to do. It's something that the committee has funded in the past. Yes, Representative Mahoney.
Do you mind if I move the bill?
Absolutely. No, I mean, I don't mind. So Representative Mahoney moves that House File 3714 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Before meeting today is 3714, that would fund the Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Program. The BDPI program grants up to 50% of the capital costs of public infrastructure needed to expand economic growth, which will add to the and retain jobs and increase commercial and industrial tax base in the communities across the state of Minnesota. And most of the grants are in the amounts of $250,000 or less. In fact, some are very small. And in Heartland, Minnesota, population 310, the grant was $25,000, and it stopped the deterioration of, increased the population growth and helped the city get more tax dollars in to make it more viable. And with that, I would love to have former Representative Dorman, another one of my vice chairs.
Representative, did you want to add something before we go to public testimony?
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I would advise all of my members to vote for this really good bill. BDPI is a great program for Greater Minnesota. It helps a lot of businesses and creates a lot of jobs out there.
Well, welcome to the committee, Mr. Dorman. Top that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Amen. The only thing I'll add is that you'll find in your packet a handout that talks about the program a little bit, talks about the grants, where it is, where it's helped, what it does, and it gives smaller communities an ability to tap into some resources to help job growth. They generally aren't the massive projects that, you know, get state-owned funding. It's been a great program since its inception, and there's one testifier I know besides me, and you're running out of time, so unless any specific questions, I'm going to cease.
All right, thank you. Representative, do you want to have that testifier come forward now, or do they wish to? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Michael Breathorst. I'm the city administrator for Melrose. A good story to share with you. We are a community that received one of the BDPI funding programs. The leverage that we used, the city provided over $6 million, and where the BDPI was $1 million. So it was a 6-to-1 match. This was the effort that really led our community to secure jobs, over 780 jobs that were retained with this partnering on this project. So, again, very supportive, wonderful program. I would very much support this continued efforts. Thank you.
there any additional public testimony on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member comments and questions. It's a good program. I know it has bipartisan support, statewide support, and it's got a fantastic author in Representative Gunther. Representative Gunther, any closing comments?
Please approve this bill.
With that, the chair will renew his motion. Representative Mahoney will renew his motion to have House File 3714 laid up for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Gunther, or the staff, do we know... there's a bonding request in for this as well, right?
There is a bonding request.
Okay, but we funded this in the general fund as well, so thank you. House File 2424. Member of the committee who wishes to move that? Representative Anderson moves House File 2424 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Gunther, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is a daycare bill, and the facts are kind of disturbing. There's 15,000 daycare slots open for the metro, for Greater Minnesota, and 3,200 slots for the metro. So we are definitely having an acute shortage of daycare slots open for Greater Minnesota. And with that, to speed things up a little bit, I would like to introduce Mr. Scott Marquardt to testify. Scott is the Vice President of Southwest Initiative Fund in Hutchinson, and good friend of mine.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, members of the committee. I am Scott Marquardt, Vice President of Southwest Initiative Foundation, based in Hutchinson. We serve 18 counties and two Native nations, Southwest Minnesota, bordered by Jackson, Ortonville, Laverne, and Litchfield, and we are one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations created in 1986. I spend my time on entrepreneurship, business finance, and regional economic development, which is why I'm here today. In September 2016, the Center for Rural Policy and Development published what I think is one of the most important papers we've seen in a long time, A Quiet Crisis, Minnesota's Child Care Shortage. In my opinion, we can change the adjective. It's no longer quiet. It's hitting our region loud and clear. It is having a significant impact on our businesses and our community's ability to attract and retain talent. Significant impact on alumni, our high school grads, thinking about coming back, moving here, taking the jobs, starting businesses, making our main streets thrive, and raising their families there. I hear it all the time on a daily basis from our chamber directors, our business leaders, mayor, city councils. It is a daily issue for us. It is growing, and it's really hitting our region hard and, frankly, all of Minnesota. It doesn't matter what sector. If you're a main street restaurant, an industrial park, an ag biotech startup in Worthington, it's hitting very hard. The ability. This bill does, I think, some very specific things that are great for our region, and primarily two buckets that I really want to focus on. The community planning process, the Initiative Foundations have been doing that work with our partners since 86, and none of these solutions, whether it's a new center, a new family-based provider, are going to be viable or sustainable without community-based solutions, realizing that this is a community and regional economic development issue. This bill specifically focuses on engaging the private sector, which is critical to success. I think from the Initiative Foundation's perspective, our secret sauce is the ability to bring the private sector to the table. We need to rewrite the narrative about child care in Greater Minnesota, or all in Minnesota, frankly. These businesses are businesses. They're enterprises. They employ people, just like restaurants, just like manufacturers. We need to rewrite the narrative for providing the respect that child care providers and the support organizations need, and this bill will do that with the investments that are being made in there. It also provides technical assistance, small business training, stuff we've been doing for 30 years, stuff that our partners have been doing as long or longer than that, and that's something very important. Just like DEED and all the great agencies provide business retention and expansion support to existing companies, this will provide it to existing child care providers and try to rewrite the narrative and attract talent in the region. You've trusted in us. The legislature has trusted in the Initiative Foundations for over 30 years. We are grateful for the support. We're confident that the data shows the ROI that the taxpayers have received on jobs, on Main Street investments, and on community vitality, and we're hoping we can bring our Rolodex and our resources to the table and deal with something that's hitting us pretty hard. Thank you.
Representative Gunther, do you have any other invited testifiers?
No, I don't.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. State your name.
Tim Penny with the Southern Minnesota Internship Foundation. I told Bob I'd be in the background, and in the interest of time, I'm really reluctant to jump forward, but I just want to echo what Vice President Scott Marquardt from the Southwest Initiative Foundation said about the role of the initiative foundations in dealing with economic development concerns in rural Minnesota. We cover the 80 non-metro counties collectively. We have done this business assistance and parent aware for school readiness quality training in our rural regions in the past. We're capable of using these dollars as described in the bill to address these early childhood needs in rural Minnesota very effectively, and I just wanted to again add those words of encouragement to Representative Gunther's bill.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, member questions and comments? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where do you get the dollar amount from? The what? The dollar amount.
Representative.
The appropriation of $1,500,000. What is that?
It goes to all the initiative funds. Is that correct?
The $1.5 million.
$1.5 million for all the initiative funds in the state of Minnesota, which covers the 80 counties.
And to Mr. Swenson, are you guys eligible to apply for the child care grants funding that we applied for, that we funded last year?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have received child care grants in both appropriations. We focus those in our region primarily on projects, not this type of thing, the project investments, especially in the nonprofit centers, to try to get them off the ground.
Representative Gunther, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, you vote yes.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, just real quickly, and I know that you're in the essence of time here. I appreciate what we're doing here. One of the things that's missing in the stuff for this committee that I hear over and over and over and over again from rural child care providers is regulations, and everybody wants kids to be safe. But at some point, members, we're going to have to face the fact that a lot of people are getting out of the child care business because of an overly regulated business climate. Thank you.
Representative Gunther?
Well, Representative Munson and I were just discussing how we're going to have meetings throughout southern Minnesota to find out what those things, regulations are that we can eliminate and make it a better, more viable built business.
With that, Representative Anderson renews his motion to have House File 2424 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney moves House File 3968 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And Representative Mahoney, is the amendment in our packet your amendment?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney moves the A18-0749 amendment to get the bill in the form you would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, the redevelopment grant and demolition loan program is a well-used program. It's not one that is funded on a regular basis. This is moves it to the base, and I could be clearer, but I've got, how should I say this? I've got a pretty good cold, so I'm kind of fuzzy. But what this does is it tears down old buildings in towns and in cities, and the demolition, and then it helps with revitalizing that particular space. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifier, who will be brief because we've got 2 minutes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Monty Holman. I'm the Senior Vice President of Real Estate Development at the St. Paul Port Authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Happy to have the opportunity to support House File 3968. Communities all across the state have been able to use the redevelopment program to clear blighted buildings, improve access and infrastructure, to bring commercial and industrial properties back to productive use, where they can be redeveloped with new and expanded businesses and new and retained jobs. We've seen this happen in cities large and small across the state. We're doing consulting work in Bemidji, in Red Wing, in Sartell, Minnesota. All of these communities in greater Minnesota can use this funding. Some of the examples where we have used it successfully in the city of St. Paul on our projects include Great Northern Business Center, home to Warner Stellium, Twin City Glass, Custom Drywall, 616 full-time family-supporting wage jobs at that location, received a $1.2 million redevelopment grant, generated $16 million of private investment. Westminster Junction Business Center, nearly 1,000 jobs across six businesses, a $2.3 million redevelopment grant there helped generate and allow for the investment of $86 million of private sector investment on the east side of St. Paul. This could not have happened without removing those barriers to investment, the extraordinary infrastructure costs and demolition costs associated with sites like this. The last example I'll provide you is Beacon Bluff Business Center, the former 3M World Headquarters on the east side of St. Paul. 912 jobs we have brought back to that site. There was a tiny little $875,000 redevelopment grant from DEED, but that helped reduce the disparity and make that site competitive in one of our lowest income, hardest hit communities by the recession, and brought $87 million of investment back to that community. In total, we've received over six redevelopment grants. Those sites are now home to 2,800 jobs in the city of St. Paul and over $207 million of private sector investment. Communities across Greater Minnesota can use this funding in a very similar fashion. We're helping coach them on how to do so, and we would greatly appreciate your support. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, did we put one-time money in this program last year?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe we put money into it last year. I think we put it in the year before.
Is that what it was? Okay, because I see there's some of the memos say that the funds have been exhausted. If Mr. Zempel, if you could just follow up with me and send me an email letting me know the history of this. Maybe I'm confusing this with another program. Okay. Representative Mahoney, did you have any other invited testifiers?
I believe there are others here, but I don't think we need to have them. Mr. Chair, people standing up there behind me. I'll try to close my comments and ask for your support. This map in your packet today shows you the opportunities. If my memory serves me right, from DEED, about 60% of the projects go to Greater Minnesota, 40% go to urban Minnesota, and the problem comes in that the urban sites are a little bit more expensive, so the money ends up about 50%.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Mr. Drummond, did you want to add anything?
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to say on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and the Greater Minnesota Partnership that we're happy to support Representative Mahoney's well-reasoned and insightful piece of legislation. Well, as he said, maybe more of the dollars flew into the metropolitan area, but, if good things happen in the metropolitan area, that's good for Greater Minnesota. If good things happen in Greater Minnesota, that's good for the metropolitan area. We're happy to support this, and thank you for bringing it forward.
What I'm giving my cold.
Yeah. Representative Mahoney with his motion. That was House File 3968 laid out for possible inclusion in a later bill. Members, check your schedules for tomorrow. Confirm the time and location for our meeting tomorrow. And then a reminder that we will be meeting on Friday as well. With that,